So there's a phrase that is very, very old, and it's almost ironic the way that it works out. And this phrase is familiarity breeds contempt. And the things that we're so familiar with, they lose their power. That phrase, familiarity brings content, contempt, is like 700 years old as a phrase. So that phrase in itself is something that probably over time has lost power in its meaning. But sometimes there are stories and there are words and there are expressions that over time, even though they're beautiful and they're meaningful, that the power is lost from them. Even something as simple as I love you. Now, if you've been married for years and years and years, maybe those words don't carry the same weight, the same power when they're said as they did the first time they're said. But the first time they're said, like two people who are like saying it for the first time, like they're still on their best behavior with each other, right? They're still like put on their best foot forward. And so those words probably don't mean as much. There's not as much like understanding and knowing the flaws and appreciating the person, not in spite of, but because of their flaws, as they're after years of marriage. So those same words, even though when they're first said, they're so meaningful. Later on, they're far more meaningful because you're more deeply known when you say these words. Well, today we're gonna talk through the story of the Good Samaritan. And this is a story that it's probably relatively familiar. I mean, we name hospitals Good Samaritan Hospital. A couple years ago, there was a famous horse that was winning all these races named the Good Samaritan. And it's like this cultural sort of iconic phrase and understanding of the Good Samaritan. That's what we're gonna do today. And so I don't want you to approach this with the familiarity that you maybe, I know this, I've been there, I've done that, I get this story. Because we're gonna take it and we're gonna use it in a slightly different way. We're in a series called The Path of Disruption, and in Luke 9:51, Jesus resolutely sets out for Jerusalem. And if you've spent any time in church, if you know the story of Jesus at all, you know what happens to Jesus in Jerusalem. He's going to go there. He's going to be lauded as a conquering king. And a few days later, he's going to be tried. He's going to be abandoned by his best friends. He's going to be beaten. He's going to be abused. He's going to be nailed to a cross, put to death. He's going to die. He's going to come back to life. All this happens in Jerusalem. His story inevitably ends in Jerusalem. But from 951 through 19, when he enters Jerusalem, he's traveling to and from different towns. And he's north of Jerusalem, and he'll be headed east. And he'll say, on his way to Jerusalem, he went this way in the wrong direction. But it's because he's always heading towards Jerusalem. He knows that Jerusalem is his ultimate destination. And so along the way, he's preparing his people for his departure in Jerusalem. And so along the way, he does two things. He tears down, he deconstructs their current religious system. And then he reconstructs how you interact with God, how you find peace and understanding and hope in God in place of it. So he deconstructs and then he reconstructs for 9.5 chapters. We introduced this last week. Today we're going to deconstruct. We're going to talk about how he deconstructs their religious system. And then next week, Jeff, our children's pastor, is going to come and help us understand how he reconstructed in its place. But like I said, today we're just going to have story time. So settle in. I'm going to be going through the story of the Good Samaritan. Gather around. I'm going to have story time. No one's going to be on my lap. Don't get any ideas. But we're going to have story time here. And we're going to be in Luke chapter 10. So if you're following along, we'll be in Luke chapter 10 the entire time. And we're going to start in verse 30. In Luke 10, 30, it says this. Jesus replied with a story. A Jewish man was traveling from Jerusalem down to Jericho. And he was attacked by bandits. They stripped him of his clothes, beat him up, and left him half dead beside the road. Now, when it says he was traveling down to Jericho from Jerusalem, you're going to see a picture right now. This right here, this is the road from Jerusalem to Jericho. See, Jerusalem to Jericho is about 15 miles apart. But these 15 miles has about 0.7 miles of elevation difference. So Jerusalem is the highest point anywhere around. And so the road, it's a steep incline if you're going to Jerusalem, or steep decline if you're going to Jericho. And because it was such a steep incline, it had to weave in and out of the mountainside as it was going up. And so because of that, there were all kinds of like rocks and caves around this path. This path from Jerusalem to Jericho, it was infamous because this was a place where robbers and thieves would oftentimes hide out and do exactly this. It was known as the Bloody Pass. And you're like, why would you anyone take this? You know, if this road is called Bloody Pass, like, wouldn't you find some alternate route? But there was no alternate route. This was like the only road between two major cities. And so people had to take it. So when it says that, when it says one day a Jewish man was going from Jerusalem to Jericho, people would have been like, oh, yeah, he got robbed. Yeah, that makes sense. When you're on the Bloody Pass. But notice here that he says two things. They stripped him of his clothes, and they beat him up and left him half dead beside the road. And we'll keep going. By chance, a priest came along, but when he, the priest, saw the man lying there, he crossed to the other side of the road and passed him by. See, there's two things about this, and it's the two things I just mentioned. The first thing is that they took his clothes off of him. They beat him and they took his clothes. And this takes place in the Middle East, and Middle Eastern people kind of all look the same, you know, the same color complexion, same color hair, same color eyes. The thing that distinguished different types of people would have been their clothing and their speech, their words. Well, he was unconscious, so he wasn't speaking, and they took his clothes. So that this priest wouldn't have known that he was Jewish. Also, in Numbers, it says this. All those who touch a dead human body will be ceremonially unclean for 7 days. And so what you have is you have the priest, and he's walking down the path, and he sees the man here, and he walks up to him, and he sees him, and it says that he doesn't have his clothes, and he looks dead. He would have known this. He went, man, like, I'm a priest. I work in the temple. Like, if I touch this guy, even if I, like, bend down and, like, check his pulse, I've touched him. He might be dead. I can't do my job because I'll be unclean. Actually, the priest lived in the temple, and so he wouldn't be able to go to his house because you couldn't go in the temple if you were unclean. And so he walked up to this guy. He didn't know if he was Jewish. He didn't know if he was alive or dead. So he kind of walks up to him, and he's like, nope. He crossed to the other side of the road and goes about his merry way. Because it was like a cost, benefit, risk analysis. Like, I don't know who this guy is. I don't want to touch him. I can't do my job. I'll be ceremonially unclean. I got to go through this whole process of getting clean again. Nah, not worth it. I'm not going there. I'm not going to do it. So he crossed to the other side of the road. Let's keep reading. A temple assistant or a Levite. This is someone who would have worked for that priest. This is someone who would have reported to that priest. Walked over and looked at him lying there, but also passed by the other side of the road. So you have the temple assistant. He's like, oh, he looks at him. But this guy, he works for the priest, and the priest already made a call. He's always like, I'm not going to help him. And he probably knew that the priest was on ahead of him. And so he knew if he was still here and the priest was ahead, the priest said, no, go. And so now he's like, oh, man, like, if I take him into town, like, I've just showed up, my boss, and my boss made the call. He's like, nope, I'm not going to do it. And so he crosses the other side of the road again. Then a despised Samaritan came along. When he saw the man, he felt compassion on them. Now this despised Samaritan, this was an area that was a long time before the Assyrians came in and they overthrew a part of the Jewish country. And then the Jews who lived in this area, they began marrying and having kids with the Assyrians. And the Assyrians were abusive people to the Jews. And so the Jews viewed Samaritans as like lesser than because they hadn't stayed with the faith and they hadn't stayed like with their own kind. And so like, man, these guys are less than us. And they were despised. And there was a history of violence between the Jews and the Samaritans. There was this history of like hatred on both sides. And so you had this guy, this Samaritan, and it says a Samaritan came along. And when he saw the man, he felt compassion. This is the first person that we get any of their feelings. Going over to him, the Samaritan soothed his wounds with olive oil and wine. Olive oil to clean the wounds, wine to disinfect it, and bandaged them. Then he, the Samaritan, put the man on his donkey and took him to an inn, where he took care of him. The next day, he handed the innkeeper 2 silver coins. Actually, that right there, the original language is a denarii. And a denarii is the equivalent of 1 day's wage. And so it's 2 silver coins. It's 2 denarii. So it would have been basically like in our day and age. Massachusetts average income per day is $180. And so in our terms, he handed the guy $360. So this guy hands the innkeeper $360 for this man he's never met before. says, take care of this man. If his bill runs higher than this, I'll pay you the next time I'm here. So you have the story of this guy, this guy gets hurt, and then these two guys, religious leaders, they pass him by, and this third guy, this despised Samaritan, he says, no, man, like, I'm going to take care of this guy. It not only takes care of him, but he goes above and beyond to take care of him. And this story of the Good Samaritan, oftentimes, like, what happens now is people in my situation are like, so you all should be kind. You all should be generous. And that's like the moral of the story. Unfortunately, that's not what this story is trying to convey. It's not trying to get like another thing that you should do. It's not another to-do list thing item for you. It's not like, be more kind, be more generous. Actually, Jesus is doing something very, very intentional with this story. And if you don't look at the context of this story beforehand, you're not going to see that what Jesus is doing is he's deconstructing something. And so instead of like saying, you know, the moral of the story, be more kind, be more generous, let's look at what happens before this story takes place so we can understand it. This is the conversation that leads up to Jesus telling this story. In verse 25, it says this: one day an expert in religious law stood up to test Jesus. And so this expert in religious law, he would have been kind of like a lawyer and judge combined. Like, rabbis taught the law, but these guys, if there was like a dispute between people on the application of the law, this guy would have heard both sides and made a ruling. And so that's who this guy is. And it says he stands up to test Jesus. So this would have been sneaky. Because if you're sitting with a rabbi and he's talking and he's teaching, and after he's done, you stand up to ask him a question, what you're doing is you're acknowledging, you're respecting him. And so you're like, Rabbi, I have a question for you. And so your act of standing while he is sitting is like this act of respect. And so this guy, he says he stands up to test him. And so it's like this act of respect. Now I'm going to prove I'm going to see who this guy is, see what he's made of. I'm going to try and snag him a little bit. He says, teacher, what should I do to inherit eternal life? And this is a big, significant, important question. This is kind of like the question, right? Like, this is the question of, how do I know I'm good with God? Like, how do I know that me and God, like, we're good and I'm doing all the right things and I'm saying all the right things and I'm like making all the right choices? Like, how do I know? He's like, God, I want to know, how do I know me and God, like, we're good? And so just, can you help me out here? Just like real quickly, Rabbi, can you tell me, how do I know that me and God, like, we're good? But did you catch the inference in his questions? He says, what should I do? He says, all right, it's clearly on me. It's clearly what I do. It's clearly how much I accomplish and how much I do the things I'm supposed to do and how I don't do the things I'm not supposed to do. So you tell me, let me know, what do I have to do to be good with God? Jesus replied, what does the law of Moses say? How do you read it? See, he can't answer that question in a way that makes sense. He can't just say, there's nothing you can do. It's not about what you do and don't do. It's not about you earning God's love. It's not about you earning God's forgiveness. It's not about what you do or you don't do. So, but he just says, all right, well, you already feel like you know what's up, so you tell me, like, what does the law of Moses say? The man answered, you must love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, all your strength, and all your mind. And love your neighbor as yourself. Now, this is sneaky, by the way, because what he's doing is he's quoting Jesus back to Jesus. Like earlier in Matthew 22, you'll see it right here. It says this. Jesus replied, you must love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, and all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment. A second is equally important. Love your neighbor as yourself. And so earlier on, someone asked Jesus, hey, Jesus, what's the most important commandment? And Jesus says, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and all your mind. And love your neighbor as yourself. And this guy, he says, so we need to have this conversation. How do I know I'm good with God? Like, what do I have to do to be good? And he says, well, you tell me. And his response is funny. It's almost exactly Jesus' words, but he adds his own thing to it. Did you catch it? Jesus says, love the Lord with all your heart, with all your soul, and all your mind. This guy says, you must love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, and all your mind. Like, he's still in this mode of, what do I have to do? In my strength, through like gritted teeth and white knuckled intensity, how do I earn? How can I paint God into a corner so that he has to be good with me? Like, what can I do? What can I achieve? How much can I accomplish so that I am good? I need to know the system. I need to know the metrics. I need to know the math. Like, tell me, what can I do to prove that me and God, we're good? Like, what's my system? Give me the system. Jesus says, right, okay. If you can love God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, and your neighbor as yourself, good. He's like, hey, man, if that's right, okay. If you do that, it's your world, baby. I just live in it, okay. Like, you're good if you can do that. What's funny about that is, like, those sound like familiar words because familiarity breeds contempt. But let's be honest. Like, how are we doing with those words? Like, do you love God with all your heart and all your soul and all your mind? Do you love your neighbor as yourself? I know for me, like, I love my wife and I love my kids. And sometimes I want to like kick my kids across the room because they frustrate me. And these are the people who I love the most in the world. So just like imagine how I feel about you all. I'm just kidding. But right, like how you love your neighbor, like how you love God with all your heart, all your soul, and all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. Like those feel like those are doable and attainable because they're so familiar. But at the same time, he might as well have said, here's what you gotta do to be right with God, jump over the Grand Canyon. And once you are like flying over the Grand Canyon, like, and you land on the other side, you're good. Like, you and God, you're peachy king. Like, it's impossible. He might as well have said, all right, squeeze your body through the eye of a needle, and then once you get to the other side of the needle, man, you're good. This idea of love God with all your heart, soul, and mind, love your neighbor as yourself, it's impossible. Like, that level, that system, any system you can come up with of, if I do this, then this, I'm good, I've earned, I've achieved, I've accomplished. And this guy, his words are, love God with my whole heart, love my neighbor as myself. And Jesus is like, all right, you go for it, man. If you can do that, you're set. You are golden. And then the guy, realizing what he had done, realizing that you can't always do that, realizing that that's an impossibility, verse 29 says this, the man wanted to justify his actions. So he asked Jesus, who is my neighbor? This question would have been something that they would have argued about and like sort of like tested. In Leviticus chapter 19, it says this, do not seek revenge or bear a grudge against anyone among your people, but love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. And so this verse right here, it says, love your neighbor as yourself, but it defines as anyone among your people. And so then the kind of conversation became, all right, well, if I have to love my neighbor and my neighbor is anyone among my people, who's my people? Because the smaller I can get that group, the less people I'm responsible to love. And so if my people is like my family, then, that's okay. But if my people is like people who are like me, who, you know, look like me, who live like me, the same socioeconomic status as me, maybe they vote like me, then if that's my people, then I'm good. Like, okay, I like all those people, so I can also love those people. But then at this point, when this guy is justifying his actions, Jesus tells the story of the Good Samaritan. And then he realizes, oh, Jesus is saying, the Samaritan is my neighbor. So it's not like this, be kind, be generous. It's, I have to love, if I'm going to create a system whereby I achieve rightness with God, you know, my whole thing, I've got it worked out, I'm doing the right thing, I'm pulling the right levers, I got enough gold stars next to my name, is love God, love my neighbor. And Jesus, all right, cool, you got that? You got that? Okay, your neighbor is the Samaritan. How are you doing with the Samaritan? And the guy's not doing well with the Samaritan. And you go after this story, to the very end of this story, Jesus is going to say, after the story is over, he says to the man, now which of these three would you say was a neighbor to the man who attacked by the bandits? Jesus asked. In the verse 37, it says, the man replied, the one who showed him mercy. So what you have is you have the man in front of Jesus, and Jesus is like, all right, well, who's the neighbor? And the guy's like, he can't even say the word Samaritan. He's just like, the one who showed him mercy? Because Jesus revealed to him who his neighbor is and the fact that he doesn't love his neighbor. And so this guy has based his entire life on this system of love God, love people all the time, and I'm good. And I've proven my worth. I've achieved. I've accomplished enough. My system is in place, and I'm going to do my system. And Jesus is like, hey, man, like, don't you see? Don't you get it? Like, your system is not good for you. Like, you can't even follow your own system. Like, Jesus kind of like, he paints him into a corner of like, this is your system. This is, you've said, this is how you live. This is your system. And you can't even do this. At this point, this man, he almost becomes like a sympathetic figure, kind of like the priest and the Levite, how all of them got painted in this corner of their system. Like they were confronted with the correct thing and the right thing. And they felt, and the correct thing with their religious system and the right thing were competing. He almost becomes like this sympathetic figure at this point because he has lived his entire life based on this system of earning God's love, earning God's acceptance, earning God's love and his forgiveness. And Jesus says, hey man, he holds up a mirror. Look at your system. Look at your life compared to your system. How are you doing? And so the man leaves. He can't give up his own system. He is so bound up and enslaved by the need to prove himself to God, to achieve God's love, to achieve God's forgiveness, that he can't even accept it when Jesus is like, hey man, this system isn't working for you. Let it go. And he walks away holding on to his system. And so I want to ask you guys, do you have a Samaritan? Do you have someone who you could never forgive? You could never love? You could never give grace to? Not because I'm going to add another thing to your to-do list. Now forgive that. This is like the way I pull the rug out. Now forgive that person. I mean, you should. But not because I'm trying to like paint you into a corner of now you need to be kind to that person. You need to be... No. Like this guy in the story, our ability to give grace and love and forgiveness to others is based on our ability to give grace and love and forgiveness to ourselves. Like if we have a system whereby it's how many gold stars next to our name, and then this person over here, I could never forgive him or her because I've got a system and they're lower on the system than I am. Therefore, and they're not just a little lower, they're way lower on my system than I am. Therefore, I can't give that person grace. I can't forgive them. I can't love them because they're lower than I am. But what this whole thing is it's a system of you earning God's love and earning God's. It's like, it's and this person is lower on your system than you are. And God, Jesus is like, hey, just forget the system. I love you. I forgive you. Regardless of your past, regardless of your mistakes, regardless of how unloving, unforgiving, ungracious you are, I love you. And that person over there, who you could never forgive, and I love them. So I want you to feel my love. I want you to feel my grace. I want you to feel my forgiveness. And then, and only then, not out of guilt and shame will you forgive that person, but you've walked in my love, my forgiveness, my grace, and then and only then can you offer it. Your ability to offer love and grace and forgiveness to others comes from how much you accept love and forgiveness and grace to yourself. And your limit of love and grace and forgiveness to yourself is the ceiling on how much you'll offer to others. We have systems whereby we earn God's love. And so I'm here today to tell you, if there's a system of how in and out you are, how in and out others are, there's nothing you can do to make God love you less. There's nothing you can do to make God love you more. He already loves you. Earning and striving and working. And if you give your money because you're trying to earn God's love, you open doors, you serve around here because you're trying to earn God's love, or you like try to avoid all the wrong things and do all the right things because you're trying to earn God's love, I'm here to tell you, you can stop. He already loves you. He's already forgiven you. You already have his grace. There's no system of earning that which you already have. Right? He's available to you, and with arms open, say, just give your whole self to me. I already love you. There's no system. Stop trying to put a gold star next to your name. It already has all the gold stars in the world. This man was trying to test Jesus. He's like, what's the system? Tell me the system. And they were just speaking different languages. He's like, there isn't a system, man. There's no earning. There's no gold stars. There's no notches. I already love you. Drop the charade. We know you're not perfect. Drop the act. Let me close with this. In Psalms 46:10a, it says this: "Be still and know that I am God." Now that "be still" there is this word that's hard to define succinctly. The "be still" there is this word "rapa," R-A-P-A-H. And "rapa" can mean several things. You'll see them here on the screen. "Rapa" can mean be still, desist, cease striving, calm down. And so that verse, "be still and know that I am God," can be desist, stop, stop. It can be like, "Rapa, desist, stop what you're doing." It can be stop striving, stop, like, stop working to earn my love. Just be still, Rapa, calm down. Be still and know that I am God. Stop trying to earn, stop trying to put gold stars, and know that I am God. Ecclesiastes 3 says that he puts eternity in our hearts. Like, if we slow down, if we slow down, if we stop striving, if we stop, if we desist long enough to hear from him, just like in that moment of stillness in our hearts, we know that we can't earn God's love, and eternity is already in there. If we slow down long enough to hear from him, eternity in our hearts says what we already know is true. That if there was any system to earn God's love, we would drop that ball. If there was any system of, like, if I always do these things and never do these things, we would fail. So Rapa, calm down, desist, stop striving, be still. And in that quiet moment, eternity in your hearts will be screaming, "There's nothing you can do. I've already forgiven you." How are you doing with others? Do you have the capacity for forgiveness for yourself, and therefore can you offer it to others? Or are you in this system? Are you caught? Are you enslaved by this system? Rapa, Rapa, calm down. Let's close in prayer. God, I'm so grateful. It's such a, like, you understand us. This is where the "I love you" is more meaningful, because you understand us. You see us. You see our flaws. You see our need to strive. And you say, "No, no, no, I already love you." And you see our sort of, like, human nature to try and earn. And you say, "No, no, no, don't. Like, you love us unconditionally. And that's so beautiful, because if there were any conditions, God, we would drop that ball every time. In this story of the Good Samaritan, it's not about on one more to-do list thing. It's this dismantling of our system. It's this deconstruction of any system where we try and earn and achieve and put gold stars, because you already love. There's no amount of us achieving that you would make you love us more. And so ultimately what happens, God, is in my heart, I'm just in awe. I'm in awe of what unconditional love looks like. I am beyond grateful for what that message is, that even when I err, even when I make mistakes, even when I am unloving, you say, "No, no, no, Rapa, be still and know that I am God, and God is love." And so we're moved by you. We're grateful for you. We are defined by you, not by our actions. We're defined by you and your love, not by whether or not we do all the right things. We're defined by you looking at us with love in your eyes and saying, "I forgive, I give grace, I love." God, this is in some ways a very, very familiar message, and in some ways a message that is so earth-shattering. And so, God, give us strength to know how much grace we give ourselves based on if we can give other people grace. To know how much we forgive ourselves based on how much we can forgive other people. It's hard to see our systems for ourselves sometimes, but it's easier to see our systems for other people. And this man with Jesus, he had a system whereby the Samaritan was on the outside looking in. But this whole thing was based on how much forgiveness and grace he was willing to accept himself. And so if we have a Samaritan, give us the strength to see that, be honest with ourselves, and give that person grace. not just a to-do list item, but from the place of us feeling your love and your grace personally. We're moved by you. We are in awe of you. We are thankful for you. We love you. In your name, amen.